Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, February 4th, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And happy birthday.
Oh, well, thank you. One more year, huh?
So what do you want to do today?
Well, let's just be together a little bit and maybe go out to dinner with Shia tonight. How's that sound?
That's our granddaughter.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo, and thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network every Monday live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember, our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com.
Today you'll hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 22 the hour. And we got another great show for you today that will include... Did Johnson & Johnson knowingly sell defective hip prostheses?
And preventive medicine saves money depending on how it's defined.
Can ADHD be treated with diet alone?
Is placebo as effective as drugs for kids with migraine?
And how can we optimize our kids' IQ?
It's great when surgeries go as planned, but unfortunately, surgeries can have complications. And my husband here, Dr. Len Saputo, had a hip resurfacing due to osteoarthritis of his hip in 2010 with an articular surface replacement, also referred to as ASR.
I thought I was so smart, Vicki, because that was the cutting edge thing. And it was a chance to really get one that was excellent. And everybody that studied it thought, yeah, that's the way to go.
I know you talked to a lot of people about it. And unfortunately, you had serious life-threatening complications.
Yeah, small detail.
And, you know, if you weren't a doctor with independent knowledge and a strong personality...
And if I didn't have you at my side as well, that would have been a big deal.
Well, you wouldn't be here today to talk about it.
That's true.
And originally we thought the problem was because your surgeon put the ASR in a little bit crooked so that the surfaces weren't matched up and the metal flaked off, causing the metallosis from the cobalt poisoning. And now it's come out that the company DePuy of Johnson & Johnson, although you had a Birmingham, but
They're pretty much the same thing. They're very much the same.
But anyway, this DePuy of Johnson & Johnson that just came out, they had a design flaw in the cup that the company was aware of and was eventually even rejected in the United States by the FDA, yet they continued to manufacture and sell it out of the country to unsuspecting surgeons. Now, this has affected 100,000 patients, and now there are 10,000 lawsuits filed. Do you think that they'll be prosecuted?
Boy, they should be. You know, that was knowing and willfully doing something that was wrong. And this happens in medicine not that infrequently. And what happens? Nobody gets punished for it.
Like with the Vioxx.
Vioxx was the exact same story. And just to briefly update you on that, you know, the company knew that it had a product that was going to cause heart attacks and strokes 5 years before it came out on the market. And they didn't tell the FDA. And then they brought it forward. And it took 5 years to figure out that 50,000 people died from heart attacks and strokes. And they knew that was going to happen then. And then they didn't admit anything. But in 2004, which was after it had been on the market for a while, they took it off. No one was prosecuted.
Now, you did a fast-track video about what happened with your hip resurfacing, but for people that didn't watch that yet, just briefly go over what your complications were.
Well, there are lots of complications that occur with cobalt poisoning. Keep in mind that what happens when you have a metal-on-metal hip is that you have an issue where you've got titanium there for sure in the that's the main thing, but the titanium is covered with chromium and with cobalt to make it a little bit stronger. But if you've got metal on metal, meaning
rubbing
both
together.
Ends, yeah, rubbing together, if that thing's not in exactly right or if it's not designed exactly right, you're going to get fragments of the cobalt and of the chromium coming out. And that's what happened in my case. And I got poisoned by it. And the levels in my body were 10 times above what were normal. And yet doctors didn't know enough about it at that time.
We thought you were dying. He was so sick. Besides the fact that he couldn't walk, I mean, your hip was so bad, you were just like doubled over. You couldn't even use the cane.
Yeah.
And you were too weak to use crutches because you were so sick.
Yeah. Well, I remember looking at my laboratory work thinking, I guess I'm toast. It's over because I worked in the ICU for 35 years. I know what the laboratory works looks like in somebody who's really sick. And mine was one of the worst I'd ever seen. And what kind of complications? You get hypothyroidism from it. That can be dealt with easy. Your blood gets sticky, and it clots easy. It's hypercoagulable, and that's a big problem because that can lead to heart attacks and strokes and a lot of other problems. Then there's a neuropathy that occurs from it, and there's also the heart disease, the cardiomyopathy that occurs from it, as well as the early failure of the joint and potential complications like cancer and even death later, maybe 10, 15 years later. So
plus
I had all those things.
Plus you had the metal ions in your blood.
Yeah.
And you had fibrosis that the doctor said after the surgery, oh, he had a lot of scar tissue, and I think he must have inherited it.
I know.
So well, what's the definition of this fibrosis?
So what Vicki is saying is that what happens when they go in at surgery, when people have this problem with the metallosis, the cobalt poisoning from the metal-on-metal hip replacement devices, is that you have a lot of cobalt there that poisons and creates problems that are very difficult to deal with because they're abnormal. And the kind of finding that the surgeon runs into is that when they open up that hip and they look at the area around it, there's a lot of scar tissue. It's called fibrosis. And because it's not infected, it's called aseptic fibrosis. That's the definition, at least the pathological definition, of problems where you have cobalt poisoning from a metal-on-metal hip device.
It was all black and yucky in there. But, you know, does this happen with hip replacements also, or this is just with this hip resurfacing?
This is primarily with hip resurfacing.
Maybe you could just define quickly what hip resurfacing
means.
That's
a good point. See, instead of taking off the head of the femur, which is the hip bone.
Instead of cutting it, sawing it off.
Usually just saw it off, and then you take a hip replacement, okay, that's made out of metal or ceramic or it's got plastic on it or something, and you ram that down into the shaft of the femur, and then you connect that new hip joint into the pelvis. And that's what a regular hip replacement is like. But when you do a resurfacing, all you do is you sand off the irregular areas where the osteoarthritis is in the joint itself. So you don't have to do any amputations of the neck of the femur is what it's called. And when you don't have to do that, it's a smaller procedure in terms of what has to be done.
So you put a cap over it, much like what you do with a crown on
yes,
your tooth.
Yes, it's exactly like a crown. Then if you have problems with that, you can always go back and you can redo a hip replacement at a later time.
Which is what you did a little sooner than you had planned.
Well, yeah, I was done. I mean, 6 months after the surgery, I was already having pain.
But you can see
and
why
9
people
months,
would,
I was sick.
So you can see why people would be tempted to do this.
Oh, yeah. And there was a fair amount done. And what we all thought at that time
well, 270,000 per year have this surgery.
We'll have hip replacements of one kind or another, not all of this particular type, not all of resurfacing. But a lot of people go to the doctors who have the most experience. And I really thought about flying to L.A. or New York or to Belgium, which is where most people were having this operation done, because they had the experience. But instead, I found the best surgeon in my area in Northern California who had done a few hundred of these things. So he should have been able to do a really good job. But as it turned out, either it was put in a little bit crooked, which is very possible, or the device itself is just faulty, like the DePuy device is. And so you wind up with all this cobalt coming off and leading to the problems we just talked about.
Now, this article says that this came out in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So why didn't your surgeon know that there was a problem with this? And why didn't the orthopedic surgeons that you went to when you had complications,
mm-hmm.
why weren't they aware of it? And why wasn't the surgeon that took it out aware of it? I'd like to know why these doctors didn't know if the FDA poo-pooed this whole thing in 2010, because you had this in at the end of October in 2010. So
right.
That was, the year was almost over.
Well, see, it wasn't quite that easy, Vicki, because the problem is whenever something new comes into medicine and things even 5 or 10 years into medicine are really fairly new. And so most doctors weren't doing this procedure because they didn't know how to do it. They hadn't been trained in it. It wasn't easy to do. If you'd only done a few of these procedures, patients wouldn't want to come to you because you didn't have
the
experience.
But if they were rejected by the FDA, why were they still doing it?
The FDA didn't reject these devices outright. What they were doing was studying it at that time. There was nothing official that says you can't use this. But there was information on the part of Johnson & Johnson in the DePuy artificial hip resurfacing device that they knew about, because the person that they had that was running this particular part of their operation was a fellow named Andrew Ekdahl, okay, who had been involved with these hips for almost a decade and knew that there were problems with it. And when Johnson & Johnson had problem with it, and they knew they had a badly flawed artificial hip that was going to be recalled, they went ahead and brought him in and said, see what you can do to save us from the giant economic cost we're going to have with this joint. At least that's what it looks like. And so now this is being taken to Los Angeles Superior Court. There are 10,000 people, okay, that are involved with a lawsuit against DePuy in connection with this device. So we know that the likelihood of this being a very serious misrepresentation on the part of Johnson & Johnson is very likely. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in court. And the question that you asked me at the beginning is, should this be something that's a criminal offense? And my answer is, why would a pharmaceutical company be immune from some kind of criminal offense when they've done a crime? I mean, they willfully knew what was happening. It seems from this New York Times article, so that's where we're getting our information, that was published on January 30th, okay, of this year, so it's hot off the press. And here we are now talking about what's happened, and we'll just have to wait and see what changes. Now, doctors, okay, you asked me why were doctors so slow to pick this up. It's because when something new comes out, they're not red hot, okay, on learning what needs to be done, particularly if they have to go back to school to learn how to do this and then get a lot of experience. And so they kind of live in denial. And I know the surgeons that I chose to take out the old device, okay, that was giving me the problem with the cobalt poisoning, thought that I had an infection because they thought, well, you know, it's 9 months after you had the first one put in. It's probably an infection. And what we should do is go ahead and give you intravenous antibiotics for about 3 months and initially go ahead and take out that hip and put in a very small device that would stabilize the hip and take out the other hip. At the same time, so the infection would clear. And then 3 months later, go back and do a total hip replacement. Now, that would be the conventional treatment. And I have to admit, I called one of the world's top experts because I had access to him in this articular resurfacing procedure. And we bantered about it back and forth, and he gave me a lot of his time. He was a very, very nice fellow who knew a lot about hip resurfacing because that was his specialty. And his answer was, no, I think your doctors are right. You probably have infection. But, you know, I worked in the ICU for a lot of years, treated a lot of people with infection. And this just didn't seem like that to me.
Plus they did an aspiration in your hip, and it didn't show any infection.
Didn't show signs of infection. The culture showed nothing. My blood didn't grow anything out. We did all kinds of fancy scans to see what was going on. And all this is happening because the manufacturer of the device is not coming out and saying, hey, we got a problem here with cobalt poisoning, fella. And you should be looking for this as a possibility. So the doctors don't want to go against what they've been taught. And so they go with what's conventional. But And it was hard for me, I'll have to say, because at that particular time, the surgeon I had said, Len, look, if you don't treat this like an infection, which I'm sure that it is, and you can forget about the cobalt poisoning because there haven't been enough cases and we don't think it's real, the actuality of what's going to happen is we'll wind up filleting your femur and leaving it open. And it'll heal by secondary processes over a period of 3 to 6 months if it heals, because it could be some kind of infection that doesn't respond to it, and you'll never walk again.
Can you imagine somebody that wasn't a doctor that didn't know anything about any of this, and the doctor said that to them, the patient's going to do what the doctor says, and they're going to be on bed rest that 3 months. And
get the toxic antibiotics.
The likelihood of their getting really sick from those very strong antibiotics would be really high.
Yeah.
And then they wouldn't even have an infection anyway.
Right. Well, see, that's the problem, because when you don't know enough about what's happening because it's new, which it is, and you haven't done the study of something that you haven't had time to go over, you stick with what you know, and then you build a case with the doctors around you, which happened. We had an infectious disease doctor, two orthopedists, who were telling me that they knew what they were doing, and would I stop acting like a VIP and just let them do what they did because they knew better? And at that point, I just fired them and said, no, that's not going to happen here. You're going to have to work with me. I'm going to play my odds that this is not infection. I have read the literature on cobalt poisoning, and that's what we're going to go with. And it paid off, because I found another surgeon who would do that. And when he did, he got in there, didn't really know what he had found. He said, I don't know what this is. You've got something bizarre here. I know that you already told that part of the story, but that's how it unfolded. And so I was basically on my own. And so the point we're making here is, one, cobalt poisoning is a reality. If you have a metal-on-metal hip, it should be checked from time to time, particularly if you have a problem with pain in your hip. And second, you need to get second opinions from doctors who know more about what this problem is about, because there are not too many that are like that.
Well, the other thing, too, was that this device was only expected to last for 5 years in 40% of the people.
They knew that. That's
and
right.
And, of course, yours was less than
mine
a year.
Was about 9 months. Yeah. And it wasn't even right then.
And then also, instead of recalling the faulty implant device, they continued to market it for 3 years after they learned that it was a failure.
Yeah, well, see, that's why what we're looking at here is business as usual. How do we try to minimize our expenses here and maximize our return on investment when we've got a product that's not so good?
It's so the maybe same. They're going to end up like the Vioxx thing and end up making enough money so that even though they go to court and have to pay off all these
thousands
of people, maybe they're going to still come out ahead anyway.
You'd have to bet on that. You know, the Vioxx people probably made about $20 billion over the time that this thing was on the market, and it's going to cost them about $5 billion to pay off. So they have a $15 million surplus there that's not all profit, because there's cost to producing this thing too. But they're going to come out relatively unscathed, and there isn't going to be any legal consequence that goes with this. So what we're seeing here is the worst of humanity, where people know what they're doing. They are deliberately and willfully misrepresenting what's happening, and even to people within the field like me. What more can you say about the state of affairs of healthcare?
So the first trial has started.
Yeah, let's see how it comes out. And let's see if for once we can start looking at not just civil charges, but criminal charges, because they are. Okay, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health, and I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on the health benefits of pineapple. And when we come back, we'll be talking about preventive medicine. Does it save money? Well, it depends on how you define it. Stay tuned.
Pineapple is not only sweet and tropical and refreshing, it also offers many benefits to our health. In fact, it's one of the most healthful foods available today. It's a member of the bromeliad family, and it's the only edible bromeliad today.
Huh.
The reason I say that is we have one. We have a plant. That's what the name of that plant is. It's on our dining room table, in case you didn't know.
Oh, I didn't know. All right.
Anyway, they stop ripening the minute that they're picked. Another thing to know, don't buy a green one thinking it's going to ripen up.
I was listening to somebody the other day say you could chop the top of it off and it'll ripen that way. Take the just about a quarter of the top.
Well,
off.
You can cut it off and plant it.
You could do that
top,
too.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. But anyway, this article doesn't say that.
Yeah.
So
okay.
You need to choose your pineapple by the way it smells, and then you'll know that it's a good fruit.
Okay.
And one of the things that pineapple is valuable for is easing indigestion, arthritis, and sinusitis and it also helps to get rid of intestinal worms.
Oh, all right.
It's high in manganese, and it's critical to the development of strong bones and connective tissue. It's particularly helpful in older adults whose bones tend to become brittle. And the bromelain is a proteolytic enzyme, which helps the body digest proteins more efficiently, and it's considered an effective anti-inflammatory.
Maybe that's why this class of drugs is called what it is, or this class of fruit is called what it is, the bromelia that you started out with.
And how does that mean anti-inflammatory?
Well, bromelain is what's in there, and so
that's where
the name comes from.
Okay, so half a cup of fresh pineapple is supposed to relieve painful joints and osteoarthritis. And in Germany, bromelain is used as a post-injury medication to reduce the inflammation and swelling, like you were just saying.
Yeah, it's used here, too, by people that know nutritional medicine. I use it all the time.
It's also good if you have a cold because it's high in vitamin C, and it also reduces mucus. And people who eat fresh pineapple every day report fewer sinus problems related to allergies. And the pineapple itself has a very low risk for allergies. Pineapple also is known to discourage blood clot development. So this is kind of a valuable dietary addition if you're a frequent flyer or if you're at risk for blood clots for other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's an old folk remedy for morning sickness is pineapple juice. And also the fresh juice and some nuts first thing in the morning can make a difference if you have morning sickness. It's also good for a healthier mouth because the fresh juice discourages plaque growth.
Interesting.
You know, I was thinking because it was acidic, it might, you know, take that plaque off. But anyway, it's nice to know that something that tastes good can be healthy besides, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a good way to go. And bromelain is a big part of my practice. I think it's really a tremendous anti-inflammatory, and we use it a lot of the time in people who have GI problems that are regulated by or caused by allergies, because the bromelain is a powerful way to digest food better so that the allergens don't form.
Well, that's good to know, and it's good to know that you can get it in the pineapple, because I had heard one time, quite some time ago, that the only place where the bromelain was in the stem.
Well, the stem has the highest concentration, but there's some in the rest of the fruit, too. That's right.
Okay, so isn't it obvious that preventive medicine will save money and we should put more resources into preventing chronic disease with lifestyle rather than treating it?
Doesn't that make just a lot of sense? I mean, the people that are arguing with this, I don't know what they're thinking.
So this report by economists argues that prevention won't cut healthcare costs. So how can this be? What is their definition of prevention?
Well, see, they're looking at early detection. So they're saying the same thing we're saying. And that's that all these tests that we're doing isn't the way to go about trying to prevent disease. That's the way to find it early and to find more of it.
And the reason it costs more money is because all these tests for early detection cost a lot of money.
Well, they do. I mean, there was a study done in 2010 in the journal called Health Affairs that calculated that if 90% of the U.S. population used proven preventive services, it would only save 0.2% of the healthcare spending. And that's true. But they're not looking at prevention. I mean, what's prevention?
We're talking lifestyle.
Yeah.
Healthy lifestyle.
You do all the things that you can do to keep yourself healthy and take personal responsibility for your health. That's got to save money.
Diet, exercise, stress reduction, getting enough sleep, and having a meaningful purpose in your life.
The way which you should. That's right. Those are all the things that make a big difference in how you do. A lot of the time what we are looking at when we're talking to idiots like this who are making these statements.
It's deceptive. It's like just really lying.
Well, they're playing a game. I mean, what's the reason for them taking the stance that they are? It's about dollars. I mean, who stands to lose money if we actually do lifestyle medicine? It's the people who are in the business of providing drugs and technology to the American people.
And costly preventative, they call preventative, quote-unquote, tests.
Yeah, but they aren't preventative. I mean, you may prevent some things after you've got a problem, and that's fine, but I'm not a big fan of doing all these tests that we're doing. We're doing PSAs and colonoscopies and CTs of the chest, looking for lung cancers, and we're doing pap smears too much.
Prostate cancer.
Yeah, all these things that we do, there's a place for them, but it takes a doctor who has experience and judgment. You want to just go out willy-nilly and start doing these tests on everybody, because we know, you know, look at the colonoscopy, which is probably the most controversial one. Should it be done on everybody at age 50? Absolutely not.
Well, they were actually saying that some of these tests should really only be done on high-risk people because it's costing too much money.
Well, that's
right.
That was
part of this.
Sure. So what if these people weren't high risk? Let's say that people had normal levels of vitamin D and say that they were exercising regularly so they were fit. What do you think the risk of colon cancer is going to be in those people?
And if they're eating lots of fiber.
Yeah, it's cut way back. So you're looking at, instead of finding a problem in 1 in 200 people, maybe you'll find 1 in 500. So does it make sense to do colonoscopies on everybody if you're going to find only 1 in 500? And you're going to cause several perforations in when you do the colonoscopy and several GI bleeds that are going to require hospitalization. It's very, very marginal.
Okay, now listen to this that they said. They said baby aspirin prevents the cardiovascular disease.
Uh-huh. Well, it does help.
And so that doesn't, they say that that doesn't cost very much money.
No.
So that they think that's a good thing.
Well, that's an example of something where you could make a case for it.
But the side effects can cause money. It costs money because
they do
of the bleeding. They don't mention anything about fish oil.
No, they don't. And they should. And that's terrible.
Because you're not going to get side effects from the fish oil.
No,
it might be more expensive than aspirin.
Not much. And it's sure healthy for a lot of other reasons too. But I would agree with them that if everybody took a baby aspirin, there would be fewer heart attacks and strokes. But it gets marginal because, you, like you said, there are GI bleeds, there are bleeds in the eye, there are bleeds in the brain that can cause hemorrhaging.
Yeah, so you don't need that risk if you just took the fish oil.
Exactly.
Or okay, then also they claim disease prevention saves money, as with immunizations, because they say that costs less than treating the illnesses that they prevent.
Yeah, well,
where do they get off even making a statement like that? Because they don't even have the data.
That's right. Well, all they're doing is they're trying to build up something without providing data, but by proclamation saying everybody knows immunization save money, everybody knows aspirin. I mean, you got to look at this stuff yourself and not just, I mean, you got to have a reference for it. They didn't have any references for that. Those are just proclamations they made in this study, which is bad medicine.
Yeah, so.
And about the flu shot, I mean, that we've gone into great detail. If you want to learn more about that, go to drsaputo.com and look up the infection deception, which is a paper I wrote that was referenced and published in a medical journal that shows and documents very clearly that that is a scam.
They also throw mammograms in there, and we already know that there's too many false results, false positives, false negatives.
Under the age of 50, it's a bad test, and in my opinion, is malpractice. We are the only industrialized country in the world that still does that in women under the age of 50. I mean, it's become a business, and now the doctors, the radiologists, have got their heels dug in saying, well, we know it works, and by proclamation, we're going to just pick the literature that we want to show you to make you think that this is the cat's meow, and it's not.
Well, they also, one of the things that they sounded like they were discouraging from doing this to everybody, or to so many people, were the angioplasties, because those are expensive.
Well, see, the angioplasties were done until just a few years ago on a lot of people who didn't have acute coronary insufficiency, which means on the verge of having a heart attack as judged by their symptoms. If they had a coronary arteriogram, which is a way of identifying where the lesions are and the blockages are in the heart, if they looked like big blocks, they just went ahead and operated on just about everybody. And what they found was only 3% of those people benefited from it, and the other 97% had to go through a procedure that was life-threatening and didn't have that much in the way of extending life.
So isn't that the problem with some of these screenings that they do at the churches and so forth,
yes,
where they travel around?
Yes.
What are those called? Carotid
ultrasounds?
Yeah.
I mean, those two are overdone. EKGs are overdone. I mean, we overdo a lot of the tests, and it's become more of a business again than a service. Now, I have to admit that when you're trying to do the right thing, because you've become a doctor and you work hard to get there, and you want to do the right thing and you want to make sure that you've got it right, that's what you do.
Okay, I just want to throw out some other things that are certainly not in something that we agree with. They say that bisphosphonate, statins, aspirin, steroids, artificial sweeteners are preventative.
Oh, well, give me a break. I mean, there's a whole lot here that needs to be studied in a lot more detail, and you can't do it by proclamation. You got to do it with your science. I mean, if we let these people go, they'd be doing things like the poly pill. remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Put these people
in everybody's water.
Yeah, they want to give aspirin, a statin, a beta blocker, and a diuretic to everybody and let them buy it over the counter.
Well,
hello?
If prevention's smart, and if you don't get sick, health care is less. Duh.
Yeah, well, that's right. All right, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuti here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio, and we'll be talking about, can ADHD be treated with diet alone? It's about time we got there, so stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health Radio. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
It's not new to us that essential fatty acids can help kids that have ADD or attention deficit disorder and ADHD by using certain omega-3 and 6 essential fatty acids. We've known this in nutritional medicine for more than 15 years.
I remember listening to a lecture by David Horobin, probably the world's most, the foremost expert in essential fatty acids, talk about this in 1998. And he related it all to ADD and ADHD, which we'll get to.
But somehow, I guess, mainstream medicine didn't pay attention to them.
Well, mainstream medicine's interested in what? Drugs.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how we think. Drugs and technologies. When you start looking at lifestyle or things that have to do with what you eat and nutrition, it's like, oh, no, the dietitians can do that.
So at last, an article was published in the January 2013 issue of the journal Pediatrics acknowledging that essential fatty acids can help these kids. However, their recommendation was to only resort to this if the medications like Ritalin, Adderall, and Concerta don't work.
Yeah, what a lame way of thinking. I mean, why would you do that when you could do something that's safe, that works a lot of the time, and avoid all the side effects from those terrible drugs?
Well, it's crazy that the authors only suggest adopting a healthy diet high in essential fatty acids as a last resort if the drug therapy that can have serious side effects fails.
Well, that's right. And, you know, they call them essential fatty acids because they're essential, meaning that we cannot make them in our bodies. We must take them in from the outside. And if we don't get them, we have all kinds of deficits that if they're severe enough, you can't survive. You'd be dead.
So what are they?
So you're looking at the omega-3 and the omega-6 essential fatty acids. When the USDA studied tens of thousands of people on three occasions looking for things like essential fatty acid levels, they found that 95% of the population is deficient in that. So is it any wonder that we have diseases that are related to that deficiency?
And we know that these healthy fats feed the brain.
Absolutely. The brain has probably got 50% of fat that is related to these. So does the heart.
Well, let's talk about what Horobin came up with, because he came up with a product, actually, called Efflux. But mm-hmm. Let's talk about the essential fatty acids that are in that so we can give people an example of these healthy fats.
Okay. The problem in kids that have ADD and ADHD, particularly boys, and this work was done in the mid-80s, okay, so it's old stuff. The essential defect is that they cannot process. They don't have the enzymes. They have a genetic defect for the enzymes that convert the essential fatty acids that we eat into their down-chain metabolites, meaning that we eat linoleic acid and alpha-linolenic acid. Those are the precursors of omega-3 and 6 essential fatty acids. We eat them in seeds and nuts and all kinds of other things in plants. And if we don't have the enzymes to process them into EPA, DHA, arachidonic acid, GLA, we just aren't going to be healthy, and we're at risk for developing all the things that we see in kids who have this disorder.
Now, I think it's interesting to talk about. We need to talk about how kids should really be diagnosed with this, because too many kids are being diagnosed with ADD and ADHD. I mean, if they're a little disruptive in class, they label them ADD. And
well,
then
it's way overdone.
Or ADHD. And then they want to give them drugs for it and all that kind
of
stuff.
Well, you can thank the pharmaceutical industry for convincing doctors of that, and they have their ways of doing it.
Okay, so it's overdiagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
So what should we really be looking for?
Well, there are tests that you can do that are very specific. If we had a child that had ADD or ADHD, I'd be doing what's called an essential fatty acid profile, where you look at red cell membranes and you measure the number of downchain metabolites that are present in that membrane, knowing how well the person is processing the essential fatty acids they're eating. Secondly, I would do either a SPECT scan or a functional MRI to show that the defects are there and that maybe a drug would be indicated if the natural way of using essential fatty acids wasn't done.
But let's talk about some of the real symptoms for ADD and ADHD, like the concentrated urine and the dry skin and the dyslexia and the dyspraxia and the night blindness and so forth. And so some of these healthy fats correct that.
Exactly right. This syndrome of ADD and ADHD has interesting associations, like the night blindness that you see. They don't have the long chain essential fatty acids in their retina, so they can't adapt very well at night. They have dyslexia, which means they get things turned around when they read it. They have dyspraxia, which means their coordination is not good. They can't catch a ball right. And we should be treating the cause, not the symptoms.
So just because they can't concentrate or they're a little hyperactive get distracted.
I mean, how many kids are like that? I mean, there's a whole country full of them because of the dysfunctional nature of how they're brought up. That's what we're dealing with. So go after the cause. And if you can find the metabolic defect, is, you know, for $150, you can do the test. And then you can use this product that David Horobin came up, which, by the way, we have no stock in. That's called Effilex. You're looking at putting all this combination of EPA, DHA, arachidonic acid, and GLA basically into a pill in different amounts. And it works because I know I've used it in my own practice.
So what makes it so controversial is just the pharmaceutical companies,
well,
I guess.
Yeah, it's the doctors, too. I remember going to a conference about 10 years ago. I got up early to go to a 7:30 conference at my hospital at the time because they were having an expert in ADD and ADHD come and give a lecture on it. And they were determined to talk about the drugs. When I raised my hand, they knew what I was going to do. They wouldn't call on me. So I had to blurt out some of the stuff I wanted to say, and it was not accepted very very graciously, which is a terrible shame because they were determined to talk to us about what they knew, but they didn't have an open mind about looking at superior ways to do it that have far less toxicity, that are way safer, and that our bodies need anyway.
Well, isn't it interesting that a healthy diet for ADHD is considered alternative treatment?
Oh, my God.
That should be the first line of treatment.
Yeah, well, these people are really just idiots. I mean, they're unable to step out of the box and see the big picture of what they're doing.
Well, let's talk about some of the foods to avoid ADHD.
Well, this is what they say, you know, and this is an association.
Well, these are foods that aren't healthy anyway.
Exactly. I mean, you don't want to eat fast foods. Red meats, a little bit. Processed meats, not a good idea. Potato chips, wrong fats, not a good idea. High-fat dairy, maybe you could limit that some. And
soft drinks,
of course. You know, you got the high-fructose corn syrup in there that's doing, or sugar, that's causing all kinds
of problems. We should avoid the refined sugar and too much sodium. And also, they need to get high fiber. And also, low folate is associated with
this. It's an interesting association. I'm not sure exactly why it's there, but that's fine.
And then, of course, the omega-3s.
All right. And this was published in the Journal of Attention Disorders in 2011. And they basically said that the kids that ate that diet, as opposed to a healthy diet that was rich in fish and vegetables and fruits and legumes and whole grain foods, had a whole different effect on the number of kids that would have ADD or ADHD.
The other thing I thought was interesting was that parents that report worsening of hyperactivity symptoms after the kids drink high sugar drinks or are artificially sweetened with aspartame. Mm-hmm. But the studies don't support this yet. They probably don't want to do the studies on it to find it out.
Well, they've been done. Actually, they've been done, but they didn't show what you'd think they would. But who in the world would want their kid to have aspartame anyway? I mean, that's just stupid. Why would you put some foreign chemical in the body that's never been there before?
Because they think it's healthier than sugar, when actually it's probably...
It may be worse.
Less healthy than
it
sugar.
It may be worse, and you certainly don't want to be using soft drinks or fruit juices that have high fructose corn syrup.
Well, one
or sugar
time
in
we
them.
Gave our granddaughter a soft drink, or she had some candy, whatever it was. And anyway, she had sugar, and all of a sudden she was laughing and giggling,
know,
and she was acting almost like she was drunk. And you said, if I didn't see this with my own eyes and hear it, I wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, you're right. Well, there we are. Anyway, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on some deep thoughts and what's to blame for occasional forgetfulness. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, is placebo as effective as drugs for kids with migraine? and how to optimize your child's IQ. Stay tuned.
A friend of mine told me that after he had a couple of beers, he was thinking about if giving birth was more painful than getting kicked in the nuts.
Oh, my God, what a concept.
Well, women always maintain that giving birth is way more painful than a guy getting kicked in the nuts.
Well,
after he was drinking some more beer and he was thinking, he told me that he came up with the answer to that question. Now, Mike says that getting kicked in the nuts is more painful than having a baby, and here's the reason for his conclusion. A year or two after giving birth, he says, a woman will often say, it might be nice to have another child. On the other hand, you never hear a guy say, you know, I think another kick in the nuts.
That's a great tip, Iggy.
And then he drank another beer.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Well, laughter is the best medicine.
Indeed.
But now I have something more serious. I have some reassurance for those who often experience forgetfulness. Have you ever walked into a room with some purpose in mind only to completely forget what that purpose was?
Absolutely.
Well, it turns out that doors themselves are to blame for these strange memory lapses.
That's what I thought.
Psychologists at the University of Notre Dame have discovered that passing through a doorway triggers what's known as event boundary in the mind, separating one set of thoughts and memories from the next.
Oh,
so your brain files away the thoughts you had in the previous room and prepares a blank slate for the new locale. It's not aging, it's that darn door.
That's what I thought.
Thank goodness for studies. So what should we do? Take all the doors down in the house?
Yeah, I think that'll solve it. Absolutely. Good solution.
Okay. So, you know, if a placebo works on pain, does it mean that the pain isn't real and that it's only psychological?
Mm.
Also, if a placebo takes pain away, wouldn't the placebo effect work with a drug? I mean, who's to say if it's the drug or the placebo
That's
effect?
Right. Well, a lot of studies are done to try and differentiate that, unfortunately.
Well, a new study published in the journal Pediatrics shows that placebo is as effective as most drugs for kids' migraine headaches. Yet the researchers of the study don't seem to recommend it. They recommend over-the-counter medicines or to quietly rest. So what's going on? Why recommend a medicine with possible side effects? The study results are written like it's bad news because no drugs have been approved for preventing the migraines in kids, instead of looking at it like it's good news because the placebo works.
There you go, being logical again. That'll get you into all kinds of trouble, Vicki. Yeah, this is really a study that we should pay attention to, because a lot of the time what we're looking for is placebo-controlled, double-blinded, crossover studies that are what we expect in science. And the best studies aren't that at all. The best studies are outcome studies. You put a nickel in a black box, a quarter comes out, and you go, wow, I wonder what did that, but I think I'd like a roll of nickels so I can have some more quarters. That's good science. And that's what we should be using to try and single out placebo.
I want that slot machine.
Yeah, I want that one too. And it's the same thing with placebo. I mean, why wouldn't you use placebo? Just consider it a black box. And you do something and it makes it better. And we get all hung up on, well, it's not ethical and we can't deceive our patients. It's not about deceiving patients. It's about trying to solve the problem without making them sick, because the treatment is a lot more dangerous than the placebo.
And the placebo cuts the frequency of the migraines in kids in half.
I know. So they have maybe six headaches a month. Instead, they're having now about three. And then they talk about the two drugs, Topamax and Trazodone. And let me tell you, Topamax is an anticonvulsant with lots of side effects, and Trazodone is an antidepressant with lots of side effects. These are not just things you take casually. And how much does it lower the headaches? One more headache per month. That's it. Would you be willing to take drugs like that to have one less headache a month than you would if you had a placebo?
Well, you know, too, there are other things that can be effective for migraines. First of all, though, let's talk about what causes a migraine. What is a migraine headache?
Well, those are vascular headaches that are that nobody really knows what triggers them. I mean, there can be problems that have to do with food allergies in the gut. It can have to do with triggers that we see in kids who have had problems with their neck and have sore necks. So a lot of Kids have had trauma to their neck. So things like accidents and stress and bad alignment of the cervical spine are all things that can lead to that kind of problem.
And how about allergies?
Well, allergies too, particularly food allergies are things that happen. And you can get into all that, but it's a lot of time and effort and expense to do that. There are a lot of simpler ways to do that. If we could just deal with the triggers for migraine headaches, that would be terrific. And so many kids are labeled as having migraine when they don't have migraine at all. What they have is just headaches that are triggered by a problem that has occurred because they've had an injury to the neck at some time, and they're sore when you palpate the back of their neck and at the base of their skull. And if you just do chiropractic alignment or do body work or use infrared light therapy. We use a photon stimulator. There are very few people.
Hypnotherapy.
Oh, yeah. All those things are great. Great approaches.
Acupuncture. That would be good, too. Guided imagery, Qigong, neurofeedback.
Yeah. These are smart things to do. And I know that probably 95% of the headaches that I see in my office, and many of which are called migraine, are relieved within 5 minutes of using the infrared light. And if you do that for several days in a row and you add to it massage, acupuncture, body work, chiropractic, usually within 2 weeks the symptoms are gone. They don't come back. And you don't have to fool around with all these drugs that can have toxic side effects.
This is sad when little kids are getting headaches like this.
Well, it is. And we need to look into what we can do to get at the cause of it, too.
And yet I didn't feel like the article had a tone where they were very sympathetic to the kids.
Oh.
They're like, give them a drug over the counter and put them in a quiet room.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe. But why not? I mean, it gets back to the role of placebo in medicine. I mean, we have all these reasons for saying placebo is the bad guy. And I'm always going, yes, placebo is the good guy. That's the best medicine there is.
Well, it works better on kids. But, you know, there was another study we reported several months ago about how adults got relief from placebo even when they were told it was a placebo.
Oh, that was a brilliant study. It was in people who had irritable bowel syndrome. And right on the pill, it was a blue pill, it was written placebo. And when the patient came into the doctor said, I'm going to give you this pill here. Read what's on the label. It says placebo. There's nothing in it. And the patient would say, well, you sure you want me to do that? Because why would we be stupid about things? That doesn't make any sense. And yet the patients that did that over 6 weeks, their irritable bowel symptoms got statistically better. So what we think, even at an unconscious level or a subconscious level, is really important, and it affects our biochemistry big time.
And like I said at the beginning, the real drugs, the toxic drugs, can have a placebo effect as well.
Oh, they do, and it's part of, you know, when we do a study, I don't know how we got into this. I have to blame the pharmaceutical industry and the technology industry of trying to do anything they can to make their product the one that is patentable and that can give a return on investment. And the way they've agreed and the FDA has gone along with is to go ahead and do studies where they do the placebo part of it. And if you have, say, a 30% benefit from whatever drug you're studying or whatever technology you're using, which is what we find in research, if there's a 30% benefit from placebo, anything over that is thought to be the effect of the drug. And that's what they're interested in. And what we should be doing is turning it exactly around the other way and be looking for why a placebo is something we want to use, because it's safe. It works 30% of the time instead of maybe 32 or 35% of the time for a lot of drugs and technologies. And it doesn't cost much. Why wouldn't you want to do that?
I remember about 30 years ago when I was having some cervical disc problems in my neck.
Mm-hmm.
And the orthopedist had put me on Valium as a muscle relaxant.
Right.
And pretty soon, I couldn't go to sleep without the Valium.
Yeah, you get addicted to it.
And so then one night, I thought, well, I'm going to stop this Valium.
Oh, yeah, good luck.
So I went to bed and I lay there and I lay there, yeah, and I couldn't go to sleep, so I was fooey. So I got up, took the Valium, went to bed. I was asleep in 2 seconds.
Yeah, right.
And the next day I thought about it and I thought, you know, that had to have a placebo effect because I know it takes about 20 minutes for that to work. How could I go to sleep so fast on that?
Right.
But that was how I got myself off of it, because then I did a half of a one the next night and the same thing happened. I went right to sleep and I knew that it couldn't have worked yet. So,
well, see, there are a lot of things like that in medicine that we try to say that we're scientific and we want to stay scientific because we know science is what we have to base everything that we do on. But medicine isn't largely science. 85% of medicine is not science at all. About 15% is. And what works? It's the art of medicine. It's the relationship with the patient. It's a connection we have with them where there's trust and confidence and where there's listening and caring. That's what it's about.
Well, I don't know. I was thinking about the sleep, and I was thinking in hospitals, if they played nice music in the background, maybe the patients could go to sleep at night instead of having to give everybody a sleeping pill, because those cause falls and all kinds of other
issues. A lot of things that are done in the hospital are done for the convenience of the staff.
Because they want to make noise, so they could be quiet and just pipe in nice, soft music.
All right.
Anyway, we have another topic here.
You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Svoboda here with Nurse Vicki. We've got one more topic that I think would be interesting to look into. How would you optimize your kid's IQ?
We all want smart kids.
Yeah.
Little Johnny is so smart, he can already talk. He said bye-bye today on his first birthday.
Yeah, give me a break.
Or John got an A on his math final.
Right.
How far are you willing to go to boost your kids' IQ? I mean, are you willing to put the time in to read to your little one and feed your child a healthy diet, high in the healthy fats we talked about earlier? Is it worth it to put your child in preschool early or keep them home with you if you don't work, giving them some quality time?
Right.
What's more important, their intellectual IQ or their emotional IQ?
Sure, well, they're both important, and it depends on what you do when you're a parent. I mean, a lot of parents, they've got so many things going on in their life, they haven't got time to be spending time with their kids doing these kinds of things you're talking about. They're more inclined to put them in front of a TV show and say, here, watch this, and just be quiet and stay in the playpen.
Well, in that case, then they're better off going to preschool and interacting with other kids. But a lot of people think that it nourishes the child more to be home with the parent.
Well, I think it does if you've got a parent that's really got the time and the interest and wants to do it.
That's not on the computer all the time.
Yeah.
They're not looking at their text messages and their emails and putting the kids in front of the TV. That's right.
You've got to listen and you have to care. It's the same thing that we do as doctors for our patients. A mother needs to do the same thing with their kids. So they did this study in a journal called Perspectives on Psychological Science in January of 2013. It was a NYU study, New York University study. There was a meta-analysis, meaning looking at a lot of studies that were already out, and they showed that IQ is affected by diet and supplements and interactive reading and early education, and that it was very significant. For example, if you gave essential fatty acids to these kids, the omega-3s and 6s, say in fish oil or cod liver oil or something like that, their IQ was about 3.5 points higher.
Yeah, instead of giving them those ADD drugs.
Well,
you know, some people give their kids ADD drugs even when they don't have them because they want them to do better in school.
This is where it's better to have a higher emotional IQ than an intellectual IQ. And it's not about so much about how smart you are. It's about how well you're adapted to life.
This is also why it's important for pregnant women to eat healthy diets and for newborns' diets to have these healthy fats, also to build those healthy nerve cells. Those are related to the to intelligence. And also, you know, they did studies on those about violence, how the healthy foods decrease violence.
These were studies that were done out of New York back, I don't know, about 25 years ago. And what they did is they just gave either prisoners or they gave to kids in school a diet that had some essential fatty acids in it. So they fed them some fish. And violence went down 44% in both. So, and the kids were doing better in school. So this is big news. And yet, we would rather look towards what can I do to not have to do it myself. And it's not about food or supplements. It's about drugs.
And I think the interactive reading is a really good idea, too.
It's
huge. There's nothing like reading a story with the kid and talking about it instead of them just sitting there and falling asleep and not paying attention. You know, get them involved with it. And when they do start learning to read, have them read a page and you read a page or, you know, do that together. It's a nice activity, even.
Well, I think it's fantastic.
Even if they aren't learning something.
Well, it's really important to include that in what you do when you raise a kid. Well, we're at the end of the show, and I'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health and to take your health questions every Monday morning on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. Sounds weird though, on the radio to get the video, but that's how it works. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week. We'll see you next time.